The Porterbrook NHS Gender Identity Clinic in Sheffield opened in its current form in January 1998, so it was about to celebrate its 10th birthday when I visited its lead clinician, Dr. Kevin Wiley, at the very beginning of 2008. Kevin is not just a gender specialist, nor is his clinic solely concerned with trans people and their issues. He chairs the British Society for Sexual Medicine and is president of the International Scientific Committee for the World Association for Sexual Health, to list just two of his other hats. In addition to his role as lead clinician at the Porterbrook Clinic, he also chairs a committee set up under the auspices of the Royal College of Psychiatrists to develop new guidelines for care of people being treated for gender issues in the UK. So the way in which he approaches the whole topic of care is of vital interest to trans people right now. He agreed to an interview, and I began by asking him how he came to the field.
Well, I came to Sheffield primarily because there was a sexual problem service here, so that was sort of helping people with sexuality and with relationship problems. And the boss of the clinic, who I'd come to work with, left fairly soon after I came for a promotion elsewhere, not because I'd come. so she said to me. And the opportunity came then to sort of expand on my time, sort of working more around the fields of sexuality and gender, which interested me more than sort of mainstream mental health issues. So I was given the opportunity to sort of go and visit various services around the country and overseas as well, to sort of see how other people were managing this, because although I'd sort of done some early sitting in clinics with people like Philip Snaith in the early 90s, it didn't sort of give to me a sort of true understanding of how people with gender dysphoria were really sort of being managed or offered ways through their transition. So it was a great opportunity for me, who as an individual is very interested in people's holistic care, with their physical and psychological health care, to be able to see how people were managing it in different areas, and then to see how we could set up a service in Sheffield that became not necessarily a one-stop shop, but provided a number of services for people if they wanted to take them from us. And that sort of allowed me to sort of see how good practice from elsewhere. It allowed me then to think about how we could deliver that locally, ask for some budget that wasn't already in the sort of funding. And that's really where we set ourselves up. One of the problems has been, I think, that we've set up such a good service for some people, or I hope it's good service for some people, that it actually, on the limited budget that we have and the funding, that we can only let so many people into the service at any one time. And it's an interesting concept that people have said, well, why don't you just offer less and let more people come along? And that's quite difficult when you've actually set yourself up to actually offer a good service, or as good as people can tell you how to change it, to make it even better, hopefully, when you're being suggested that you actually get rid of some of that.
And the service is just coming up to its 10th birthday, isn't it?
Yes, next week. We've just realised we've been running 10 years again in Sheffield, in the new style multi-disciplinary clinic.
What do you think has changed in that time?
Well, I think one of the big issues that has really changed is the way the society has come to accept diversity, not just with gender expression, but with sexuality and with with expressions overall in people's ability to sort of accept outside of the standard norm, which of course has been something that's been so restrictive and stigmatizing people, or allowing them to be stigmatized by society. And I think that sort of acceptance, you know, has come about in leaps and bounds, part of it through policy, part of it through politics, but a lot of it, I think, just sort of people's general acceptance, perhaps through information, through the diversity now of the internet, the television, the multi-channels that are available, and people having much more access to be able to let people hear about differences outside of the very standard norm that was sort of given to people as the only way that things should happen, not just in gender but in sex and in relationships.
Do you think that changes the way that people see themselves as well when they come to your clinic?
Some people, I think, are more confident, and I think that really helps them when they're going through their transition, because they know that it's not going to be as bad, because they've already started to experience in some way how, when they've been waiting to come to the clinic. They've been trying things out and actually seen that it's not necessarily as bad as it is sometimes portrayed. I mean, of course, people have bad experiences, but so do people, you know, who aren't experimenting or trying something different. You know, I mean, we can all walk into the wrong scenario or the wrong situation and have a bad experience, but if we let that colour our life, we'd then never go out or try something different again. I mean, obviously, some people are still very troubled and concerned, you know, that the problem that they're coming to the clinic with, you know, the gender dysphoria, is something that isn't going to be accepted or isn't going to be recognised or appreciated by society or by doctors or by clinics generally, and that is a problem for them, sort of getting their trust and helping them understand that, you know, that there are different ways of being able to make that transition and to start to enjoy the options that are available to them.
Of course, one of the big questions for many people is whether this is an area that should be the concern of psychiatry or should be more general medicine. What's your view on that?
Well, I think my view has always been throughout my training that the doctors who are interested in something and have got the skills should be the people who are looking after patients with that particular condition. And it doesn't really matter whether, you know, they've got the name of psychiatry or neurology or endocrinology under their name, because those are just old-fashioned terms that people have conveniently managed traditional conditions with. In sexuality and in gender, I do actually believe that, you know, you don't need to be of one particular discipline of training. You need to obviously have a grounding, and you need to have an interest, and you need to have a skill set, but those can be acquired, you know, whether it be from psychiatry or general medicine or general practice. And I think it's really important that people sort of feel confident to appreciate that and to then allow themselves to be able to offer that service to people. Because, you know, sometimes, you know, people say, oh, well, you know, you trained as a psychiatrist, so why are you doing that, or why are you offering that kind of service? I said, well, that was something I did 10, 15 years ago. It gave me a good grounding in certain ways of practicing medicine, but I also, you know, did general medical training, and, you know, we can't lose that either. And if people want the best of both, then you need to be able to go to the doctors, the physicians, who are able to offer all of that. Not necessarily getting blurred dual roles, but being able to sort of see that for different people, different things are necessary, and having a team of people around you so that people are able to select out the bits that they need and find the right person that they gel with, if they do need a talking therapy, for example, to be able to get that.
I'm picking up from there that perhaps you've become more flexible yourself over a period of time, and maybe other practitioners have as well. Do you think that's a general move that is happening in this field?
Yes, I think people are sort of seeing that it isn't just a case of that initial hurdle of getting making sure that somebody doesn't have a mental health problem or a mental illness or a psychiatric diagnosis, but that, you know, that people's needs are much greater than that, but they don't need to be overly pathologized. They just need good medical care and input, and that can be offered by people who've got the skills and experience of managing hormones or talking therapies or other related issues, you know, whether it's, you know, you can go and see a dermatologist about your hair or an endocrinologist about your testosterone, but if that endocrinologist or dermatologist is only seeing one or two people and you're actually seeing 20 or 30, who would you prefer to go to at least in your first choice? You know, who would you imagine may have the greatest skill and expertise of managing that particular issue in a subgroup of patients, whatever the diagnosis?
Now, many people will know that you've been in a particularly strong position to appreciate the debate that's going on because of your position chairing the committee for the Royal College of Psychiatrists and the other Royal Colleges. Now, that's been running since 2002. Could you give us a little bit of background about that and where that's moving to now?
Yes, I think time was was sort of pressing at the time that we were trying to put together some modern ways of managing transition and helping people with transition in the UK, because at the time the standards of care were seen by many people to be very US-based, and although it came out of the Benjamin Society and it was an international society, it was still seen to not necessarily reflect the needs of British people. So what started off in a sort of rather happy way has, I think, now developed into a greater consensus of opinion between medical specialists and people in the related clinical fields to actually find a way of providing a number of options for treatment and support and therapy through a transition, that people are going to be more able to sort of have control and influence about which of those are going to be best suited for them at a particular time. And I think that's something that, you know, maybe clinicians generally have to sort of experience a bit of themselves before they feel confident that it's okay to do that, because there's often a lot of fear in traditional medical practice that you're going to be scrutinized and criticized by your peers, and whilst of course you've still got to have good evidence-based medicine and, you know, have all the ethics and codes of conduct that are appropriate to your practice, it doesn't mean that you have to do things the way that things have always been written in textbooks, because medicine moves on. And I think in gender care that's been particularly the case, you know, with good examples being seen, you know, not just in the UK but, you know, around the world now in various centres, you know.
So are you saying that the practitioners like yourself feel under less peer scrutiny, less critical peer scrutiny than before, and therefore able to be a little bit more perhaps experimental or maybe experimental is maybe not the right word, but flexible?
Yeah, I think that flexibility is the important thing, and I think as society has changed as well, I think the medical world has as well. More people are sort of offering the opportunity for services in this field and wanting to sort of find a cohort of similar-minded clinicians. You know, we have many people come and visit us. You know, we've had endocrinologists and public health physicians and psychiatrists all coming to this clinic to sort of see how we do it, and then going away and setting up something comfortable for themselves, but, you know, it may be similar, maybe in a different way, but that these are groups of people that we can then relate to and have meetings with and sort of support and sort of help find ways forward, you know, not just to support the clinicians, which of course is important, you know, for us in our day-to-day work, but obviously then to also learn and see how it's helping patients in different environments in different ways, and actually getting away from this very linear model that and very symptom focused which we're very good at being trained at in medicine, and which is only just starting to change as we know the medical curriculum is doing.
So coming back to your committee's guidelines then, the you had a large public consultation last year over Christmas 2006-07, and the consultation finished in February 2007. What's been happening since then?
Right, well, we certainly had lots of responses after the end of the official consultation period. And then
about 200 in total, is it?
Yes, and a lot of written submissions, some of them very detailed and lengthy, some with very constructive suggestions, some telling us, you know, of ways that we could change, some being very praising, some of being very critical still of the way that the guidelines have been written. And I think the diversity of the nature of what was being consulted on, because it wasn't just about psychiatric diagnosis or psychotherapy, but it was also about the standards of care of everything that seemed reasonable to include in a document that was appropriate to physicians across all the medical specialties, which is why it's been so good to get all the colleges on board, from surgeons to physicians to psychiatrists to general practitioners to public health. You know, everybody's been offered the chance, and also all the related clinical fields like speech and language therapy and nursing and psychotherapy. And of course, lots of user consultation as well. I mean, I think something like a fifth of the committee is made up of users, which is quite a high proportion.
Is that unusual within medicine to have had such a large consultation on a guidance document like this?
Absolutely, and I mean, of course, you've then got to get all of the colleges then to support it. So we had to get all the colleges to agree to the draft statement. And now, of course, once the committee meet later this month in January, and we hopefully get a wording that everybody will, on the whole, sign up to, we've then got to get it back to all the colleges, hopefully, with not too many changes, that they're going to have to scrutinise it for another 6 months before they either approve it or want to change it in some way. But we'll have to wait and see how that goes. But I think the consultation has been wide enough, and the people who've been analysing it have hopefully been independent enough that people will see that what's been brought out can be incorporated sufficiently for people to feel that this is at least a way forward. It won't be ideal, but nothing's ever ideal for anybody. But if it's a move in the right direction, then I think we will have helped and succeeded, you know, in actually bringing a little bit more legitimacy to this across the fields of medicine for patients.
And obviously, as you know, trans people are very vocal about their concerns about the way that care should evolve. Just to finish up, if there was one thing that you could change from the perspective of being the head of a clinic and working very, very closely in this field, what would you change?
I think it would be to try and offer a way of reducing the suspicion that people walk into the clinic with, that we're not there to help them, and that we're only there to try and find something to show that there's no legitimacy in what they're telling us, so that they feel cautious about sharing information with us or for talking about anything that they may feel insecure or uncertain about. And I think that's something that as a clinic we're starting to address, and I hope that we'll find a solution that will help give that reassurance to people, because just there are going to be so many hurdles that people will face in society, in medicine. They have to see that we're not there to stop them, and we want them to have a dialogue with us if they feel that we're not helping them, and to share that with us.
Do you think you're winning that war?
Well, it was one of the things that came. We set up a meet the clinicians a few weeks ago, and the person who facilitates the peer group, which is something that the clinic, except one person, none of the other clinicians go into. And this was one of the ones that they wanted to have most reassurance about, that they were able to sort of talk about some of these things, and it wasn't going to come back at them in a negative or detrimental way. And I think when we were able to share that with the people who were attending, they actually heard that, you know, we're there doing our day-to-day job and we're there to help them as we are in any other aspect of medicine. And, you know, I think if people can hear that often enough and see it happening, then they'll be more confident. But I think that's something that will take a long time for people to actually really shout up and say it's happening all the time or most of the time.
What would you say to your peers who might be thinking of getting into this field and being interested in working with trans people?
It's a challenging area. It's something that's very rewarding because, you know, the more that you offer in the clinical field, the options are great out there to get, you know, real good job satisfaction. I think you have to, you know, recognise there's a little bit of noise on the periphery, you know, from people who've got other issues, you know, which sometimes are legitimate, sometimes are mental health related. But the vast majority of people with gender dysphoria are not there with mental illness, and so you don't need to be sort of frightened about talking to people and getting involved and helping them in a way that you would, for example, with somebody, you know, having hormone replacement therapy, whether that be a bloke or a woman, you know, in a normal biological sense. But even that, you know, is something that, you know, lots of people have anxieties about, you know.
Kevin, thanks very much.